Welcome to Race, Health, and Happiness. I'm your host, Dr. O. This season, I am interviewing guests from around the globe about how they thrive personally and contribute to their communities. In the last two episodes, I interviewed guests from the United States, and in this episode, we round off our American tour with Bambi Salcido, the president and CEO of the Trans Latin Coalition. I would strongly suggest also checking out our previous episode with Dr. Lulu, who is a physician, a Black queer woman, and the mother of a transgender child. I think that episode will inform and enrich your experience with this episode. All right, let's get to it. It's not enough to survive in this racialized world. We are learning together to thrive. This is Race, Health, and Happiness, and I'm your host, Dr. O. The Trans Latin Coalition is an organization of transgender Latina immigrant women. It was formed in 2009 as a way to create voice, visibility, and community for its members across the United States. Focusing on quality of life strategies, this network of trans Latina immigrant leaders work towards laws for protection, human and civil rights, healthcare, and social and cultural inclusion for their community. Today, we get to hear from trans Latin activist Bambi Salcido, who is the president and CEO of the Trans Latin Coalition. Welcome, Bambi.
Thank you so much, Dr. O. I appreciate the opportunity to be present here and, address the beautiful audience that are part of this podcast.
Fantastic. Awesome. Thank you. So for this podcast, one of the things that I ask my guests first, right off the bat, is what is your superpower? But I recognize that you are leading a very powerful organization. And so I'm curious about both. So let's start with your organization and then your personal superpower, the gifts that you're bringing to this world. So for the Trans Latin Coalition, what would you say is the superpower of the organization?
Thank you so much for that question. I don't think I've ever had that question asked. But I am going to say that the Trans Latino Coalition is a small but mighty organization. We are an organization that it's unapologetic, that does whatever needs to be done in order to better the quality of life of trans, gender nonconforming, intersex people. We are an organization that have influenced the broader trans movement across the United States. And so I guess there's not just one power, but there's many different powers, that different people bring into the table. It is, I would say, the most strong power that we have is the collective power that we hold.
I love it. The power of the collective. And for you, as the leader, at this point in history, what do you feel like your superpower is in general, actually, not just as the leader, but as a human being on this planet right now?
I don't ever think of that I have power. Other people think that I do have power, but I consider myself a servant to the people, and I think that is one of my major strengths, I recognize that I do have privilege, right? And I also recognize that, has been my people who has brought me to become the person that I am, right? I am a product of my people. And so that is obviously through my ancestry, through, you know, trans people, you know, and my people are people who are at the margins, you know, people who are resilient, people who are sex workers, who have been homeless, who have been incarcerated, who have been, survivors, like you said, you know, sexual violence or any type of violence. I am a survivor or a survivor of many different challenges, but also, you know, I recognize that, you know, because my people believed in me, I have become and been able to overcome those issues and overturn them into opportunities.
I think that's really key. I think that's one of the things we're going to dive into, right? Like taking those challenges and turning them into opportunities. And thinking about your journey, and then thinking about the, and then we'll come back to the Trans Latin Coalition. You know, I watched a YouTube interview where you explained that you always knew who you were, right? Even as a child. And that at age 17, you felt that in order to live authentically, it meant leaving home and moving away. Can you explain a little bit of, you know, what did that mean as far as living authentically when you were, you know, 17 and under, or why you felt that way?
Yeah, you know, early on in my life, right, I always struggled to trying to find myself, right? Always seeking, you know, love and support, you know, through my family, which unfortunately, you know, the background that I had with my family in terms of, like, you know, I come from a very poor family, like very working family, like very low levels of education, like second and third grade levels of education, barely like known how to write and read. And so, you know, and also, you know, my father leaving my mother before I was born. And so, like, finding my mother, you know, trying to find ways to, you know, to provide for us, right? And so, you know, she had to work a lot. And so, like, there wasn't, like, really this family structure, right, in place. And so, you know, for me, I was always longing that, right? And I was always wanting, you know, that love and support and the comfort and the nurturing. And so, you know, my escape to all of that, right? And also trying to understand myself at an early age, you know, my escape was drugs in the streets, right? And so I started, you know, using drugs when I was about 7 or 8 years old. And I essentially grew up on the streets in Mexico. And I started being institutionalized, you know, when I was young. I started being incarcerated at age 12 in juvenile halls and all of those things, right? And so, you know, my mother not really knowing what to do, and then having had the opportunity to meet my father at age 15, my father was living in the United States at the time, and he offered for me to come, you know, to come to the United States. And so that was also like another escape for me, right? Like, again, trying to find myself.
So leaving Mexico to the United States to be with your father.
I came to the United States when I was 16 years old, and, you know, then come to the United States. My father had his own family, and like not being welcome into, you know, his family and all of that. So like always trying to like find myself, right? And so when I turned 18, I was like, okay, you know, I'm gone, you know? And so I left, and that's when I came to Los Angeles.
What part of the United States were you at the time?
My father, so I was in a couple of different places. My father was living in, like, in Central California at that time, at this like farm worker place called Visalia. And then from there, I went up north to a small little town that is also called Gridley, California.
No
and
way.
So,
Okay.
So yeah, but so like all this process lasted about, 2 years. And then I decided to, again, trying to find myself and, and left to Los Angeles because I was raised in a city in Guadalajara. And so, I was used to the city, right? And so I was like, I can find whatever in the city, right?
Yeah.
And so I came to Los Angeles and, again, trying to find myself, I started my transition and, here in Los Angeles, I found myself also like, being caught up on the streets, doing crime and all of that. And it took about 14 years of my life of, incarceration, going in and out of institutions to become who I am today.
To find that person that, you describe. And that's a major journey. I just want to kind of rewind a little bit and pause in a particular place because you mentioned that when you were 18, you then moved to Los Angeles and began your transition. At what age, or do you remember at what age you felt like the gender that you were assigned at birth didn't match with who you are or your true self? Do you recall?
Yeah, I think, my spirit has always been me, right? But again, now I'm able to understand, this social constructs, right? And how we are, our children essentially are corrupted into, thinking what, grown-ups want them to think, right? So I do want to say that in my case, it was no different, right? I grew up in Mexico, a very religious place. My mother, very Catholic, brought up Catholic and, and all of that. And so, internally, I knew that there was something that wasn't matching to what I was being told, right? But at the same time, that's what I was told. So that I had to go with that, right? And so like creating this confusion for myself. And again, because I didn't have that support that I needed, right, to even or even have the ability to even ask questions or even like express like I'm feeling, this, I don't even know what it is. But, and so not having that, I think, caused a lot a confusion for me, which, again, what I'm now able to understand is, that in order for me to sort of like try to fill that gap and feel, everything that was going on around me, my escape was, the streets and drugs and all of those things, right? It's like it was always for me a way to forget whatever was going on with me.
Right. So if I understand correctly, it's like your spirit is telling you that you're not, like there's a misalignment between what society has said that, at that time you were assigned to like a little boy and feeling that, no, it's just your spirit is telling you that you are a girl, you're a woman. Is that, understanding correctly? Like that's the tension, like you're in constant conflict, even as a child, right? Like what society is saying you have to be and who you feel you are. And so you're on this search and this journey for this, but it seems like it's almost tormenting. Am I correct? And
for sure. Again, in that, like I now understand that I always, in my spirit, right? Like I knew who I was, but then I couldn't be me. Right.
Right.
And so, I had to, try to find myself and part of that was, when I came to Los Angeles, right, to be the person who I am externally, right, that matched the internally. But with that, there was also a cost, right? And I'm talking about, in the 80s, right? In the 80s, there wasn't no resources or any types of support for people like myself, right? The only the only opportunities that we would get in terms of like employment would be, I don't know, maybe some people doing like impersonations, but that was about it. And everybody else that I knew, you know, it was on the streets doing sex work, you know, and so that's where you would find your community. That's where you would find any type of resource that you would need, you know, whether it was housing or something, you know, like we would, you know, we always have been social workers, right? We always have provided for our own people.
Pause. Did y'all catch that? Bambi said that real slick, real calm, but that's a mic drop statement. She said, we have always been the social workers and provided for our own people without the resources for us to do the actual work. That is so powerful. And although I'm not a transgendered woman, I can relate. In fact, any of us from communities who have experienced marginalization and structural oppression should also be able to relate. How many of us, our mothers, aunties, uncles, have played the role of the unofficial social worker, supporting community, showing up, caring for children who are not theirs, helping folks navigate, advocate, or just provide that hug or needed meal within our communities? Yes. Now, I recognize that taking on that role is so much more dangerous, yet crucial, within trans communities. But in the spirit of solidarity, resistance, and love, can we have a moment of silence for all the unrecognized, unofficial folks, often lacking the formal training, but still becoming the de facto social workers within our communities? Big up to all those doing it now, and to those, like my own mother, who did it their whole lives and are now with the ancestors. Much respect.
You know, we always have been social workers, right? We always have provided for our own people. It's just that, you know, we have never have gotten the resources in order for us to do the actual work, right? Or being recognized as the work that we have done for many years. And that was the reality, you know, back then.
And may I ask, I wonder, like clearly you needed, and in Los Angeles, you in many ways found, you know, the saying, find your tribe, right? Like you found folks who were on a similar journey as you, who had same experiences, but were marginalized so much that there weren't a lot of opportunities or options. And especially if one wants to, you know, pay for surgical transition or all of that, then sex work is what people needed to survive or even to actualize their reality. I have a question about intersectionality, though. Do you think the journey is different? So, you know, you are a Latina woman. Is the journey different for somebody who is racialized or somebody who is an immigrant, as far as even the journey of finding one's tribe and the resources available for supports?
I mean, definitely, there's different layers to all of it, right? You know, like if you are an immigrant, for instance, you know, like many of us flee our countries of origin because of the violence that we experience, right? And not only that, but also the family rejection, and like there's different factors that pushes us for us to flee our countries. But the main reason is, you know, to try to save our lives, right? And so that in itself, you know, we have to be displaced, right, in that way. And then we get to this country, for instance, or other countries, right? Like people go to different countries, to Europe or, you know, the United States. And then we find ourselves in, you know, at a place that is not ours. We have to accustom ourselves into different customs, beliefs, language, you know, even food, right? And so that is, that's another layer, right? And so, you know, like here in the United States, for instance, right? You know, a lot of times we are also detained, right? And so we are incarcerated. Well, you know, when the only reason that we get incarcerated is because we're trying to save our lives. So what is it? Do we get murdered or do we get incarcerated, right? And so that's oftentimes what happens. And then even, you know, through the advocacy efforts that had happened, you know, from organizations like ours and others, you know, trans women are being released, but cases are pending and they don't have courts until like, you know, 2 years from now. And in the meantime, they're in limbo, right? And so, you know, in some ways, we are set up by the system to continue to be a part of this recidivism system, right? That continues to keep us incarcerated, right? Because the system pushes us to engage in the street economy in order for us to survive. And then, you know, what comes with that is obviously criminality, incarceration, and then ended up back in immigration detention, and oftentimes, you know, being incarcerated for many years, or oftentimes even, you know, after being incarcerated for so long, you know, oftentimes we sign our death sentence, essentially, right? Like we prefer to just go back so that we don't have to be incarcerated. And so, you know, it's definitely different layers of situations that happen, you know, versus someone who is born here, for instance, right? Like someone who transitions, who is born here, obviously have the ability to have a social security number, you know, and have a little bit more of, you know, resources or support, right? You know, but, you know, there are some things that are sort of like universal for the broader trans community, right? Like, you know, whether you're, you know, born here and you speak the language or not, but employment discrimination is, you know, it's a universal thing that it's constant within the trans community. Also, accessibility to healthcare services, you know, it's another thing. Obviously, you know, the fact that we as a community are still included in the DSM-5, for instance, right? Like that there's a diagnosis that says that we are dysphoric, right? That we have gender dysphoria, right?
It's pathologized in psychiatry.
Right. Yeah. And so like all of those things contribute to the institutional violence that we face.
Pause. So here, Bambi is referring to the DSM-5, which is the fifth edition of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, DSM. It's also nicknamed the Bible of Psychiatry because it guides psychiatrists' assessments and diagnoses of their patients. But unfortunately, the medical field, in particular psychiatry, has a bad legacy of pathologizing different groups and in particular, pathologizing their reactions to oppression. For instance, has anyone heard of the term drapedomania? In 1851, American physician Samuel A. Cartwright diagnosed runaway slaves as having a psychiatric condition called drapedomania, which was used to explain why some slaves would try to flee captivity. So according to this physician, wanting to run away was a psychiatric condition. Similarly, prior to 1973, homosexuality was a psychiatric condition. With regards to transgender issues, being a transgendered person was also classified as a psychiatric condition, called gender identity disorder. Now, admittedly, since 2013, there has been some progress in this regard. Gender identity disorder was replaced by the term transgender dysphoria. Now, dysphoria basically means distress or discomfort or, you know, like a mild sadness, but not quite to the point of depression. This has been considered progressive because it places the emphasis on the distress rather than a person and making it a disordered identity. But many activists argue that this is not good enough, noting that the root cause of the distress is actually transphobia and the awful way we treat trans people. According to the website TransHub, the distress could be considered through the lens of being a social condition rather than an individual person's medical issue. And so it would be a social condition due to misgendering children, structural barriers to dignified care, or due to subjecting trans people to everyday discrimination and cruelty. Now, I can't help but wonder that if we address those societal issues and trans people feel supported, they may not have gender dysphoria. In fact, maybe they might have gender euphoria and experience acceptance and joy. Now, I could be wrong, but we will only know when we start to treat trans people better.
Also, accessibility to healthcare services, you know, it's another thing. Obviously, you know, the fact that we as a community are still included in the DSM-5, for instance, right? Like that there's a diagnosis that says that we are dysphoric, right? That we have gender dysphoria, right?
It's pathologized in psychology.
Right. Yeah. And so like all of those things contribute to the institutional violence that we face, right? And so, again, there's some things that are universal, but there's some things that are unique to particular populations.
And each one, I guess, each layer or barrier, you know, makes it that much more challenging. Like, you know, I know, you know, the statistics, particularly, I think it's for, we know for like Black trans women, there's a high murder rate. We know for trans folk in general, especially trans youth, there's high suicide rates. And recent studies also that have come out recently showing that for trans folk overall, even if it's not an issue of suicide or homicide or something like that, there's still a lower life expectancy because of just the stigma and the marginalization and everything that you just said. Like basically you're so marginalized, you can't enter the workforce, you end up doing, you know, sex work or other work that actually puts you at risk of incarceration. And then all of that builds up to, you know, being involved, like you said, in other criminality or other issues that end up impacting people's life expectancy. So I think that's why it's so amazing and so vital that you do this work with the Trans-Latin Coalition. Can you actually take us back? Because the Trans-Latin Coalition has not existed forever. Like when, like, did you notice, you know, that there weren't enough social services? Were you there in the earlier days, you know, the origin story, or was it more, you know, others that you've heard from? But how did it come about?
Yeah, you know, I do have the privilege to be one of the initiators of the Trans-Latino Coalition. I don't want to say the initiator because, you know, again, it's a collective effort.
Absolutely.
Right. But yeah, we actually started in 2009 simply because of a need, right? In 2009, there was two prominent national trans-led organizations that obviously were doing amazing work. But unfortunately, we're not including the needs and issues of trans Latina immigrant women at the time.
Pause. Now, I don't think white folks or folks from other dominant groups realize that there are complex forms of oppression
within just about any marginalized group, racialized or otherwise. This happens all the time, whether it's white American trans folks not recognizing the needs of Latinx trans folks, or white passing Latinx folks not realizing the needs of Black Afro-Latinx folks. Or, even more complicated than that, sometimes it's the transphobia that exists within LGBTQ2S+ communities. For instance, major heroes like Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, who are Latina and Black trans advocates, respectively. They were at the forefront of the LGBTQ movement, but were shunned and marginalized by mainstream gay rights groups. And I know for a fact that when Marsha P. Johnson was murdered, Black communities did not stand up. I could go on and on with many different examples of this, but the point is, as you pile on the intersection of identities and oppressions, if it is you who's at the center of this, then you become the minority within the minority. And the more vulnerable you become to violence and silence, because no one speaks up for you. The impact can be devastating, frustrating, and lonely, because every human being needs to have a sense of belonging. Now, I'm speaking to BIPOC folks now. The different forms of discrimination that occur within our communities need to be recognized, and we need to protect and affirm our most vulnerable members, whether it's in the living room, the boardroom, or in the streets. To quote the Black queer poet, who is now an ancestor, Audre Lorde, she said, "Without community, there is no liberation. But community must not mean a shedding of our differences, nor the pathetic pretense that these differences do not exist."
In 2009, there was two prominent national trans-led organizations that obviously were doing amazing work, but unfortunately were not including the needs and issues of trans Latina immigrant women at the time. And so being that this work was happening, but also that we in some ways were left behind, understanding that the needs and issues of trans Latina immigrant women were not addressed or included, we wanted to obviously make sure that we do something about it. And so during a statewide conference here in California that took place in Los Angeles, I actually was part of the planning committee. So I had a little, I requested a room for us to meet, and I made sure that trans Latinx people from across the state were invited and participated in this conference. And so we had this initial meeting. And then, the same year in 2009, I was invited to be a keynote speaker to a national conference. And so as part of my package, I also requested a room within in the conference space for us to host a meeting, and I just printed flyers and posted them everywhere, and called for a meeting. And I remember that there were 32 trans Latinx people in this conference of 5,000 people that came to this initial meeting. And so that's how we started, and so we started like on a volunteer basis. We would mm-hmm. come to conferences. We would apply for scholarships, and we would come together and plan our work plan for the next year. And that's how we functioned for the first few years. In 2012, we did the a very first study research project to highlight the needs and issues of trans Latina immigrant women who were living in the United States.
What were some of the highlights from that study or major findings?
Well, some of the things that we talked about, right, that 99% of the people who participated stated that they come to this country fleeing from the violence that they experienced in their country. You know, the lack of opportunities to employment, you know, the lack of opportunities to health care, and obviously, you know, the language barriers and, you know, the acculturation that happens. So all of those things, you know, came to be, but this was something that, you know, have never been highlighted before, right? And so we now have information as we understand, you know, if there's no documentation of the need, then the need is non-existent, right? And so so we understood that, and that's how we, you know, we made sure that we did that through our national network. But one of the interesting things that happened also was that as we were, you know, trying to organize nationally in the different chapters, you know, one of the recurring themes that we were hearing was that, you know, members of our community didn't have access to basic services that people, you know, need, right? And so in 2015, our national group got together again, and we developed a strategic plan, and we decided that in order for us to address that gap in our community, that we also needed to move into service provision. Yeah, and so that's how we started, you know, building the service provision part of it here in Los Angeles, and, you know, understanding that this was sort of like the model for other chapters to follow. And now there's other chapters that are also providing supportive services
across the United States. No, and that is fantastic. I think, so one thing that, you know, there's many things that, you know, I reflect on in thinking particularly about BIPOC communities, right? Like, so many of us have, you know, the legacy of colonization has kind of impacted our lens that we had pre-colonization in many, many communities around two-spirit people or trans or non-gender conforming folks or intersex. You know, I've read about communities, African communities, where you're actually a person would not be assigned gender until the age of 7 because it wasn't just based on their organs or their biology, right? It was really based on the energy and their spirit and that kind of thing. You know, I know in many African and indigenous cultures, people who are two-spirited or trans or non-gender conforming were considered to be very much in touch with their spirit, right? In the spirit world, and were respected in that way because it was like you had a connection, a deeper connection than most folk. And I saw that even in my own, I'm Igbo from Nigeria, but I've seen, you know, the historical and even like present day manifestations of that. But then the opposite has happened through colonization, where it's extreme cruelty, extreme violence, right? So it's not just an issue of marginalization we're talking about here. We're talking about violent marginalization, whether it's physical violence, emotional violence, or just the violence in a, you know, being in a capitalist world of being denied work opportunities. And so I think that's what makes what you did in as part of the collective. So I know that it isn't just one person, right? That's what, you know, mainstream media always likes to do. It was part of a collective. It was folks coming together. But I think I want to highlight this really for anyone who is listening, who is experiencing anything like this, or who's experiencing other forms of oppression and marginalization. What you've just described, of coming together as a collective to create change is such a protective factor, is such a way of being able to resist and be healthy and be well. Our society always says it's, you know, the individual. That's a very Western way. But in reality, if there's going to be change, if there's going to be wellness, once there's marginalization and oppression, power is in the collective. And so do you want to talk actually about some of the programs that, you know, let's fast forward through time. Let's talk about what you folks, because you folks are just really disrupting even at the political level. So do you want to talk about some of the individual programs you have for folks and some of the programs that you are doing to kind of create change at the society level? Why don't we start with the person? What are you offering to the individual in the community?
Yeah, well, first, thank you so much for, you know, providing this historical context, right, about, you know, well, essentially colonizers, right, like from the very beginning, right, they're trying to erase our existence, right, through, you know, violence and through, like, you know, the indoctrination of religion and, like, a lot of the different things, right? But nonetheless, we have, you know, we have resisted, right? And we have,
yes,
you know, because we are resilient people, we continue to be here, right? Despite the multiple attempts to erase our existence. And, you know, you also touched about, you know, how, you know, primarily Black trans women are, you know, the primary targets of murders. You know, it's the reality that we experience as a community. But then again, you know, our resiliency obviously speaks for who we are as people, right? And, you know, that's why we as an organization, even though, you know, the name of our organization is the Translatina Coalition, and, you know, we started as specifically focusing on addressing the needs and issues of Translatina immigrant women, right? And we have evolved into making sure that we unapologetically claim our space within our society, that we're visible. And so we believe as an organization in the direct empowerment of our community through service provision, right? Because you cannot organize people if people are struggling with food or housing or the basic things,
basic
right?
Needs.
And so, so we are an organization that functions with those two arms. We, you know, we support our community directly with those basic needs that people have, but also we, you know, we disrupt the institutional violence that have marginalized us and oppressed us for many years, right? And so, so we influence change in the institutions that continue to marginalize us and oppress us. And so, we use those two arms and we influence, you know, we believe that if we also empower ourselves politically and economically, academically, and all of those ways, right, that we are going to be able to create those changes. And so, that is why we have, you know, empowerment sessions for our community, right? That's why we...
Oh, you have empowerment. Can you talk about the empowerment session? Like, I know that you have, like, healthcare programs. I know you have programs for folks who've been incarcerated and, you know, all of that. But I didn't know about the empowerment programs.
Yeah, so, you know, we believe in policy changes, you know, that need to happen, right? And so, you know, I cannot be the only one who is advocating and, you know, and creating those policy changes, right? Like all of our people, you know, should have the ability to do that, right? And so we, you know, we have done, you know, we have developed curriculums specifically to empower our community. To do specifically that, we have done, you know, policy academies to empower members of our community, not just statewide, but also nationally. You know, we have pushed for legislation that have, you know, made history, and not just here in the state of California, but You know, this year also in New York, they follow, they submitted another piece of legislation similar to the one that we did here. So, yeah, so we believe in the empowerment of our community, right? Like, if we're able to understand how systems work, right, we can very much influence those systems and create the changes that need to happen, right? Again, you know, we as a community, you know, need to be empowered and need to advocate for our specific needs. And that's why we do these trainings regionally and also, you know, in other places, right? Like, for instance,
that's
like
amazing.
Right now, we're doing a training in San Diego and in Orange County for people to be able to advocate at the local level too with their with their elected officials, right? Like, an understanding how we can influence all of that so that they can get the resources that they need locally.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
It's just bringing me flashbacks isn't the right word because I wasn't even alive, but it's making me think about like the work done by like the Black Panther Party back in the day, right? Like,
totally.
Folks would come to classes, right? And
I
learn.
Mean, you know,
about
there's
systems.
Models that have been created for us to learn, right? And like, that's, I mean, I'm so like grateful that you mentioned that, because that is exactly sort of like, you know, how we're thinking about, right? Like, and these are models that have created, that have been created for our people, and that could be adapted. And so, yeah, we get food every day here. You know, we have clothes for people. We, you know, we have multiple programs here. We have a house, right, which is our Hope House, which is an acronym helping our people evolve, right, like to provide shelter for people who need it, and also like a temporary housing for people to transition to a more permanent situation. So, you know, like, we do workforce development, we do reentry services, we do HIV prevention, we have legal services, we have, you know, multiplicity of programs. You know, there's 28 of us working here now.
Wow. Okay. So it's grown a lot since 2009.
Yes.
You've got multiple services helping the, you know, a person in their everyday life who's experiencing the marginalization of being both Latina and transitioning. And then you've got the empowerment and disrupting at the political level. I believe I read that you, you know, and spoke in front of President Biden. So many things that your organization is doing to improve people's everyday lives and improve the collective, right? As far as the collective and changing the system. Do you have any success stories or any stories of overcoming that you want to share?
I have so many, 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 many stories. But, you know, there's one particular story that I do want to share, and that is, I'm not going to say a name of the person, but this person, you know, spent 23 years in prison. Wow. When she was in prison, you know, because some of the things that we do, you know, pre-pandemic, we would go also to prison and also, you know, empower our community, like to let them know what their rights are and like, you know, how to, you know, do things to contact us if they need us, you know what I mean? And like, we can fight for them on the outside, yada, yada. Right. And so, this person like wrote me and I wrote her back, and, she got out after 23 years and, you know, she came straight to our organization and, you know, we supported her, and, you know, she, you know, she went through our Hope House and like, you know, then she started. So like right now she's working with us, you know? And so, I just love, and obviously like this story, there have been many stories that I have seen over the 25 years that I've been doing this work, you know, and so when I get to,
may I ask just what type of work is she doing with you? in the organization?
Well, yeah, she's done a couple of different positions, but I don't want to say the position that she's doing right now because
fair enough, because then it'll say specifically. Yeah. Okay, but is it just like a leadership role or speaking or, you know, like something?
She's, you know, at the forefront here, providing services, like many of us.
So inspiring others.
For sure, I just, you know, I believe in anonymity and, you know, I need to ask permission if, you know, if I'm going to disclose, you know, their names.
We wouldn't want that. I just wanted the spirit of it. I'm thinking about somebody listening and hearing 23 years of incarceration, came back, and now I think the big thing is now is inspiring others, right? And working with others in a similar situation.
What I can tell you that right now, she just got her own place like a couple of weeks ago. Know what I mean? And so, you know, she's working, she's, you know, she's supporting our community. She's definitely, you know, a beacon of hope for many others, you know. But I have known young people who I've known from like 12, 13, 14, 15, and they're now like 30 and they're like blossoming in the world, you know, like doing their thing. You know, and so like to me, that's definitely what fills my soul, right? Like what continuously lets me know that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, that I am, you know, that I'm supposed to, you know, that I'm walking my path, just like, you know, the path that it was laid for me. And so, you know, for me, that's just incredible that I get to serve my people the way, you know, the way I do.
Yeah. And I understand that it's been a long path for you, and I'm sure a difficult path for many of the folks in the collective and those working in the coalition. But one thing that we always ask is, like, what brings you joy? Are there moments of joy at the Trans Latin Coalition, or is it joy, you know, when you step away from work? But, you know, what brings you joy, Bambi?
You know, there's different things that brings me joy, but it, certainly what brings me joy into my heart and fills my soul, it's when I see the sparkle in the eyes of people, right? Like, I've seen many shattered souls who have come through our organization that, you know, I get to see the sparkle of their eyes. And so, to me, that's, you know, the most rewarding thing that I can, you know, that anyone can get. And that's certainly that I do get every time.
I love that. The sparkle in the eye, the reigniting of hope, I think is such a beautiful thing. So with that, I thank you, Bambi. I thank you for the work that you are doing. You know, I'm a doctor, and I can also just say it's preventive. It is life-saving when we give hope to others and resources and everything that you are doing. And so I want to thank you for the life-saving work that you're doing and for speaking with me and for all to hear about the need for this type of work and for the compassion and love that we have to have for our fellow human beings. So thank you so much, Bambi.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to have this conversation with you. I really appreciate the opportunity, and also shout out to the beautiful and amazing listeners who are going to listen to this podcast. And if I can just, you know, do a shameful plug.
Yes.
You
know,
please.
No shame, just plug.
Yes.
Proud plug, a proud plug.
Proud plug. Yes, I'm going to say that from now on. So thank you. I'm going to say, please do support the work that the Trans Latino Coalition does, but also, you know, don't just support the Trans Latino Coalition, right? Like, support other translator organizations and groups. You know, there's a group that is happening in your localities, and it is important that we elevate trans leadership. So do support, you know, translate groups around you, you know, like contribute in whatever way that you can. You know, it doesn't have to be monetarily necessarily, but, you know, your might and your talents are also welcome, you know. And so, and just, you know, continue to uplift the spirits of trans people, you know, that definitely goes a long way. So thank you again so much for the opportunity.
Thank you. And in our show notes, we will include information about the Trans Latin Coalition, as well as some Canadian resources that are trans-led organizations. So thank you, Bambi.
Beautiful. Thank you.
The Race, Health, and Happiness podcast was created by Dr. Ani Norum, and she's our host. I'm Dr. Carl Cabasell, executive producer of the show. Our technical producer is Obadiah George. Our showrunner is Cam, and JL Joseph is associate producer. Promotions coordinator is Jordan Gibson, and Javiera Violeta Duran Quieres is our logistics coordinator. Tamika E. Latibodier is our research consultant, and Corrine Bent Womack is our anti-racism consultant. Our student associate producers are Xavier Oshinowo and Afia McIntosh. Veronica Ng is our graphic design consultant, and the RHH theme song is composed and performed by Gold Keys. Special thanks to Awit Siam and Darrell Carpentier for their voiceover work. Do you have questions, feedback, ideas to share? We would love to hear from you. You can connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at Race Health Happy, and check out the show notes for research that was referenced in this episode, as well as other bonus material. Our website is racehealthhappiness.com. Thank you for listening to Race, Health, and Happiness, and please subscribe to us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. This is Dr. Carl. On behalf of the whole RHH team, we'll talk with you soon.
The Race, Health, and Happiness podcast is brought to you with help from Toronto Metropolitan University and with support from subscribers and listeners like you. Overcome the obstacles of racism while staying happy and healthy. Donate today at patreon.com/racehealthhappy. We are learning together to thrive. Thank you for your support. The Race, Health, and Happiness podcast is made better by the skills, knowledge, and creative passion of the journalism students who work right here on the show. These students join us from Toronto Metropolitan University. Thank you for the hard work, folks. We appreciate you.